Let's turn in our Bibles, please, to Exodus chapter 30. Exodus chapter 30. And while you're turning and while I'm turning there, just one other announcement. Don't forget, I've only mentioned this a couple of times, that we are planning to have Vacation Bible School this summer, June 24. If that's a Monday, I don't have the dates right in front of me. I think it's June 24 through the 27th. It's a Monday through a Thursday. We're going to have it in the mornings, so it'll start, I believe, around 9 o'clock, and it'll go until noon. And does anybody know what the theme is other than Abigail? How do you know, Jaden? Did your mom tell you? Oh, you did. Sharon? Christmas in June. And so that's the theme, and we're looking forward to that. So those of you with children, number one, make sure you plan on being here for that. And others of you willing to volunteer and help with that, would appreciate your help with that. Exodus chapter 30, we're looking tonight at a tax imposed by God. You thought only the IRS did that. And we're going to see here in Exodus 30, beginning in verse 11, a tax imposed by God. Obviously, we're looking at this chapter. It's the furniture of the tabernacle, and this is part two because the furniture was also introduced in chapter 25. In chapter 25, you had the Ark of the Covenant, the table of showbread, and a golden lampstand. Then again in chapter 27, the altar of burnt offering. Last time we looked at the altar of incense, which is verses 1 through 10 of chapter 30, and we recognize there, as we mentioned in the men's prayer breakfast yesterday morning, that the altar of incense has to do symbolically of prayer. And we mentioned this verse, let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. So now there's one other piece of furniture in this chapter, but it's not what is mentioned next. The other piece of furniture is found in verses 17 through 21, and that will be the brass laver. But tonight we want to look at something else. It's the atonement money for tabernacle service. Four things I want us to see about this atonement money for tabernacle service. First of all, the time of the tax. Let's look at verses 11 and 12. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, when thou takest the sum of the children of Israel after their number, then shall they give every man a ransom for his soul unto the Lord, when thou numberest them, that there be no plague among them when thou numberest them. Now notice what it says there. It says, when thou takest. That's not really too much of an offering if it's something that is taken, and yet it is something that is collected. So it is collected. This is not passing an offering plate. This is a required offering. And really, it's more of a tax, as I mentioned up here, because a tax, as we're going to see by definition, is what fits this definition here. And you're going to see in verse 16 that it is a tax. This is a God-imposed tax upon the people, and yet we're going to see it's not on all the people. So we want to see that it was a requirement. Secondly, it was a registration. The purpose of this tax was also for a registration or a census. The actual registration is delineated in a book of the Bible that has to do with numbers. Can anybody guess what book that might be? Blake. Very good. Has to do with numbers. So if you go to the book of Numbers, let's just turn to Numbers because I'm going to have you look there. And would you please out loud tell me the name of the book of Numbers? But it's not. And that's why I asked that, and that's why you look at me cross-eyed. The actual Hebrew title, and I just recalled this, I had studied this years ago. But the actual Hebrew title for the book of Numbers is actually, let me get to it. Drum roll. It's found in verse 1, and the Lord spake unto Moses in the wilderness of. That is the actual Hebrew title of the book of Numbers, what we call the book of Numbers. It's in the wilderness of, and it comes from verse 1. So if you were to pick up, and I was looking at my Hebrew Bible when I was studying this, and I'm looking at the title going, that's not the word for Numbers. So that started making me dig. And then I found out that it is actually, let me see if I can pronounce it, Bemidbar is the Hebrew word. And it literally means in the wilderness of, and it comes from verse 1. The Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, with the word letters LXX, that's for Septuagint, labels it arithmoi, or numbers, because of the prominence of census figures in this book, and yet the Hebrew title is quite appropriate to its general theme, Israel under God's training in the wilderness. So the Hebrews call it in the wilderness of. We call it Numbers, or for speaking Greek, arithmoi. Now you're going to see here in Numbers chapter 1, and it's what we actually, if you go back to Exodus 30, keep your finger in Numbers chapter 1. Exodus 30, verse 12, it says, when thou takest the sum. Now Numbers chapter 1, and if you look at verse 2, take ye the sum of all the congregation. That word sum occurs in the book of Numbers more than any other book of the Old Testament. And so let's look at Numbers chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. When the first registration was taken, take ye the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel after their families, by the house of their fathers, with the number of their names, every male by their polls, from 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel. Thou and Aaron shall number them by their army. So we're getting a little bit more light on what is taking place in Exodus 30. This registration in Exodus 30 is what we see actually happening in Numbers chapter 1. Jump down to verses 18 and 19 of Numbers chapter 1. And they assembled all the congregation together on the first day of the second month, and they declared their pedigrees after their families by the house of their fathers according to the number of the names from 20 years old and upward by their polls. As the Lord commanded Moses, so he numbered them in the wilderness of Sinai. Verses 47 to 49 now. And you're going to see one tribe is exempted from this numbering. But the Levites, after the tribe of their fathers, were not numbered among them. Now this is significant. For the Lord had spoken unto Moses, saying, only thou shalt not number the tribe of Levi, neither take the sum of them among the children of Israel. Now a second registration takes place in the book of Numbers. It's at the end of the book of Numbers. Go with me to chapter 26. Let us notice this second registration that takes place. But before we actually look at these verses, verses 1 to 4 of Numbers chapter 26, why do you think a second registration is necessary? Well, when you think about what happens in the book of Numbers, what takes place in Numbers chapter 13 or thereabouts? Remember what takes place? Spies are sent to spy out the land. They come back. 10 give a bad report, 2 give the good report. And God then declares, this is what's going to happen. All of you above the age of 20, you're going to die in this wilderness. You get to Numbers chapter 26, and those have all passed on. So a second registration is next necessary. That's why you come to Numbers chapter 26, and you read in verse 1, and it came to pass after the plague. Now, what's the plague? Because the others have died off, but now there's a plague for what took place in chapter 25. From the idolatry, God, in chapter 25 and verse 9, kills 24,000 in a plague. So a renumbering is necessary. So Numbers chapter 26, verse 1, it came to pass after the plague that the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saying, Take the sum, here's that word sum again, of all the congregation of the children of Israel. Could somebody turn this fan off above me? Yeah, oh, thank you, Chris. Take the sum of them, 20 years old and upward, throughout their father's house, all that are able to go to war in Israel, and Moses and Eleazar the priest spake with them in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho, saying, take the sum of the people from 20 years old and upward as the Lord commanded Moses and the children of Israel, which went forth out of the land of Egypt. So here they take this second registration. The purpose of my going through all this is to mention the sum. The word sum literally means heads. Take the heads. I'm not talking about the head on your body. I'm talking about, it's another word for take the principal, take the leaders, take the chiefs. And so it's mentioning these men who are 20 years old or above. And then we're going to talk about this in another point coming up. But then it says in, going back to Exodus chapter 30, after their number, three times in verse 12, there are words relating to numbering. After their number, and then twice it says, when thou numberest them. So certain people are being numbered. And yet this is more than a mere counting or a census. It is an inspection that leads to organization. It's a mustering of the troops. But there's something more obvious suggested in that word numbering. It's ownership. A.W. Pink says, the most obvious thing suggested by numbering is ownership. And he even uses this illustration. It is natural for me to number the books in my library. It is not natural for me to do that to Ron's. Do you have a library, Ron? Yeah. It wouldn't be. Why would I be overly concerned with the number of books that Ron has, unless I'm in a competition? But I number mine, and it has to do with ownership. And so the action of numbering says something about those who are numbered. These are mine, and I assign them their place as I will. This is speaking of ownership. God is saying, these are mine. You're going to see the word ransom here, which is related to the word atonement here. These belong to me. And so the ownership, that same ownership is seen in Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 26. Lift up your eyes on high and behold who hath created these things that bringeth out their hosts by, out loud please, by number. This is, I own these things. He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one faileth. God owns them. Another verse, Psalm 147, verse 4. He telleth the number of the stars. He calleth them all by their names. God owns them. You say, well, those are things. Those are material planets. God owns us. We belong to him. He owns these who are being numbered as representatives of their tribes. These are the heads. These are the principals. These are the chiefs. These are the leaders. And this numbering is taking place because God is trying to teach the nation of Israel, you belong to me. I own you. And so they're being numbered. In Daniel chapter 5 and verse 26, here's the sentence that was pronounced upon Belshazzar. Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Your kingdom, Belshazzar, does not belong to you. It belongs to me. And he numbered it. He said, your kingdom's been numbered. It's finished. God asserts his property rights and the power to do what he wants to do with his own. Now that brings up something that takes place at the end of 2 Samuel at the end of 1 Chronicles. David numbers the people. And you read there that it was a sin. Why then, knowing what we know now about ownership and who these people belong to, now think this thing through. Why would that be so offensive for someone to number the nation outside of God directing it to be done? And the answer is, David was interested in claiming for himself that which belonged to Jehovah. He wanted the pride of saying, this is how big my army is. When it was not his army, it was God's army. It was self-glory. This is David warring after the flesh rather than the power of God, thinking that what I am going to do, look at this number. You know what? We're strong. We have how many people? We can defeat any nation by the number we have. That is rejecting, that's leaving God out of it. And David's heart smote him after he did this. Joab, his commander, said, don't do it, don't do it. And in fact, Joab refused to number a couple of tribes because it was such an egregious sin to him. God asserts his property rights. Somebody said that it is dangerous to use religious statistics for the praise of man and not for the glory of God. And that's sometimes what we do. You know, let's number. You know, how big is your offering? Well, ours was. How many people attend your church? Well, ours. And it's you know, it used to be the joke when pastors got together. They always said, well, how many are you running? And that's very true. That's what often happens. As if this pastor has a church of 500, wow, he must really be doing a great work. Really? Well, he may be. But if that's what we're emphasizing, we're numbering, we are using statistics for the praise of man and not for the glory of God. It was a registration. It was a ransom. And that's what you see in right in the middle of verse 12, that they shall give every man a ransom for his soul unto the Lord. The word ransom is related to the word atonement. And that's a word that you see in verse 10 of the same chapter. It's also called the atonement offering, these verses 11 to 16. The atonement is mentioned again in verses 15 and 16. When you talk about the word atone, it has to do with to atone or to cover by offering a substitute. In other words, something is given to cover for a responsibility that the offerer cannot fulfill. So you go back into the previous chapter and you read about the atonement. For example, Exodus 29 and verse 36 talks about offering a bullock for a sin offering. Why? Because I cannot. There has to be something in my place because I cannot offer myself. God is saying, okay, if you're not going to offer yourself, then there must be a substitute to cover for you. And so here in chapter 30, this ransom is called atonement money. So money is given, but the money here is not given in place of somebody's life. Although it says a ransom for his soul, it's not for his life. It is for in place of a responsibility. What responsibility are these men giving this money to cover? What is that responsibility? We're going to see that again, as I said, in verse 16. But then it goes on to say that there be no plague among them. And this implies that if this money is not collected, if this registration does not take place, there would be a plague among them. By the way, did the children of Israel know anything about plagues? Had they seen any plagues? I mean, obviously, they're just now in the wilderness. They had just come out and they had witnessed the 10 plagues upon the Egyptians. And God is now saying that there be no plague among them when thou numberest them. So there we see the time of the tax. Now we see the amount of the tax. And this is a lot of what I'm telling you right now are just facts and data. But we're getting somewhere with this. Believe me. The amount of the tax, verse 13, this they shall give. Everyone that passeth among them, that refers to the process of counting one by one, everyone that passeth among them that are numbered from 20 years old and above shall give an offering unto the Lord. Now, the first thing I thought of when I read this was, well, they already have coins here? They already have coins. Is that really true? They've just come out of Egypt and they've got coins? And the answer is probably not. Probably not. So I did a little study on this. I went to the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. And it said this. They had these metals, silver and gold, cast into a convenient form for use in exchange, such as bars or rings, the latter being a common form. Jewels of silver and gold were probably made to conform to the shekel weight so that they might be used for money in case of necessity. And so the word shekel, and I think I have that on my next slide, was the standard of value as well as of weight. So when you think of shekel, we're thinking, okay, that's how much it's worth, but it's also how much it weighs. So it was a way of weighing, like we would say, well, that weighs a pound. Well, that weighs a shekel. And that shekel then becomes the value of that piece of silver or that piece of gold. And so as you're reading this, remember when Abraham's servant went and found Rebekah for Isaac? He took and put bracelets upon her, the Bible says there in Genesis 24, 22. It was probably the weight, and it was something of value that was put around her wrists. When the bundles of money were carried by the sons of Jacob into Egypt for the purchase of corn, they were probably silver rings tied together in bundles. But then there was another kind of silver that Benjamin found in his sack. What was it? It was the silver cup. And so the silver would have been weighed by how many shekels it was, which then constitutes its value. And so the shekel was the standard of value as well as of weight, with gold and silver as currency. Now, go to chapter 38 of Exodus and note something. This really will help you as you study the book of Exodus. All these, it's almost like trivia that I'm giving you right now. It'll help you understand some things about the tabernacle. Exodus chapter 38 and verse 22 concludes the construction of the tabernacle and the furniture. It says, "And Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, made all that the Lord commanded Moses." So everything we're reading about here, the furniture and the covers, the curtains and all, now it's all been made. But where did the silver and the gold for the furniture and for the sockets, and where did all that come from? Well, we know that they had spoiled the Egyptians when they came out. But then how then are you going to get the people to give toward the construction of the tabernacle? Well, they gave offerings and they gave willingly, but there was more than that. And this is what we see in verse 26 of chapter 38. "A beka for every man, that is, half a shekel, after the shekel of the sanctuary, for everyone that went to be numbered." Here it is. They've been numbered. "From 20 years old and upward." Now, how many of them were there? 600,000 and 3,550 men. So now, what is spoken of in Exodus 30, verses 11 to 16, about they should be numbered, now that has taken place so that the construction of the tabernacle can take place. Where did that gold and silver come from? Well, it was measured in shekels. And above the offerings that were given by people. And here's what we have. The shekels being given. Now, when you go back to Exodus chapter 30, we're kind of interested in, well, what is a shekel? I think in Israel today they still have money by the shekel. When I was there, I'm almost sure I had some shekels in my pocket. And sometimes when we joke around each other, "You have any shekels?" You know, we're talking a little bit of Hebrew there. But here, the smallest form of the shekel was the gerah or the gerah. Here you see this in verse 13. "This they shall give everyone that passeth among that are numbered, half a shekel. After the shekel of the sanctuary, a shekel is 20 gerahs, an half shekel shall be the offering of the Lord." So how many gerahs would it be? 10. So their offering, or their tax, is 10 gerahs per person that is to be given. Okay? So the amount of the tax is 10 gerahs. So I got to thinking, well, how much was that? And so I was reading George Bush. Remember, that's the commentator, not the president. And he states that a half a shekel was not far from 25 cents of our money. Well, that's not much. But now remember, George Bush wrote his commentary in 1843. So I had to do a little bit more work. So I went online. Let me see if I can find it. Okay. So I found out that the half a shekel, when you go to the inflation calculator, which you can find online, by the way, that was interesting. I'd never seen this before. The rate of inflation from 1843 to about 1960. 1960. What happened around that time? Right around there. There was this, I don't know if I'm accurate on this. Somebody else would have to help me on this. But I just remember that we went off the gold standard somewhere around there. And now, and so the 25 cents, I remember when my dad was a kid, 25 cents, that was a lot of money. Well, it was in 1843 too. But the 25 cents that George Bush talks about in 1843, I discovered that in 1973, when I was earning money, was now worth $1.50. And today, it's $8.59. So, you can see the rate of inflation, but that's not why we're talking about this. So, how many men do you have? 603,550 men. So, I'm trying to calculate how much money was given. And so, 5,184,494.50 was collected. Would have been, in our money today, that's how much money was collected for the building of the tabernacle. That's above and beyond the offerings that were given by these people. And it says there in Exodus chapter 30, after the shekel of the sanctuary. And somebody stated this, it was by the standard shekel which was kept there in the sanctuary that all others were tested. Each must be full up to the required weight. The standard, I don't know where they get this, that it was kept in the sanctuary and perhaps in Solomon's temple, but the standard weight was kept in the temple, in the tabernacle. So if there's ever any question about, okay, did you really give me a shekel? Well, let's put it in a scale. Let's get the shekel from the tabernacle. Let's put it on this side. Give me your shekel. You're trying to rip me off. The shekel of the sanctuary is quite a bit heavier. Come on, add some to it. So the shekel of the sanctuary is what it's talking about there. Then we look at the status of the taxed. Who are these who are being taxed? Well, you know pretty much who they are so far. But when we look at the age, it's found in verse 14. Everyone that passeth among them that are numbered from 20 years old and above shall give an offering unto the Lord. Them that are numbered are designated as those who are 20 years old and up. Then we notice the gender. And the gender is found really in verse 12 where it's designated as every man. And then Numbers chapter 1, all that are able to go to war in Israel. And so it's males, and it's those who are 20 years old and upward. And some believe that the very old men were exempted from this, but I don't see where that's mentioned anywhere. So gender, ability, or excuse me, age, gender, and ability. Let's look at the ability for people to give and how this would differ from one to the next. Look at verse 15. The rich shall not give more, and the poor shall not give less than half a shekel when they give an offering unto the Lord to make an atonement for your souls. In other words, it's not designated. It's not by ability. Ability to give is not an issue. No one gave according to ability. In fact, it is purposely stated that all gave equally despite economic status. The poor gave as much as the rich, and the rich did not give any more than the poor. Well, now we really come to the end of it. Verse 16, where we close, but this is really the application. How was this tax to be used? And you've already known it because we've seen it. But you see in verse 12, again, the word ransom. And here in verse 16, it is called atonement money, and thou shalt take the atonement money of the children of Israel. And as we stated in that previous point, the money is given not in place of one's life, but in place of a responsibility. What was that responsibility? And here we read of in verse 12, and shall, or verse 16, and shalt appoint it for the, out loud please,
service.
The service of the tabernacle. How is the service of the tabernacle going to take place? So with this money, they bought sacrifices, they bought flour, they bought incense, wine, oil, fuel, salt, the priest's garments, and so forth and so on. But the tent must also be maintained. Do we have any present illustrations of this? Yeah, I mean, we've got our own property here. And we tend to think, you know, that having a church building is not biblical, because in the book of Acts, they all met in somebody's home. Yeah. And all of a sudden, there are 3,000 of them. And pretty soon, they began to see the necessity as time went on. You know what? Let's buy it. Let's get a place where we can meet together. And we can all be together at once. And so all this, obviously, when you have something like this, it's got to be maintained. How's it going to happen? Well, everybody will volunteer. How do you think that works? How do you think that works? Everybody will just volunteer. Everybody will see the need and they'll just jump in and do it. You know what? I can tell you, it doesn't work. It does not work. Because everybody's thinking is, well, somebody else will do that. And that other person you think is going to do it is saying, well, somebody else will do that. And that's how things don't get done. So you have to have a spring cleanup day, a fall cleanup day, and then you've got to come up with, okay, how are we going to clean the church? Well, let's come up with a system whereby everybody has to clean the church. If you remember, you have to clean up the church. Well, then you have people exempting themselves from that. And so, who's going to do the work? How does it get done? You see, they face the same things here. Or we face the same things they faced. It's the nature of man. And the excuses that people will make and the things that won't get done because of the excuses that we give. The tent's got to be maintained. But furthermore, this tent has to be transported. And this is what is so interesting. You get to the book of Numbers, and you've got these boards. Remember the boards? I mean, this is some time ago. They've got boards, they've got curtains, they've got the Ark of the Covenant, they've got... And so God instructs Moses to break it down by the certain sons of Levi. And so you've got three of his sons, or the three sons, and they are... Does anybody remember their names? Gershon, Merari, and Kohath. And so now the tabernacle is transported by the three sons and their descendants, which numbers out to, I think it's like 8,000. They're transporting. Now just think about it. Wouldn't that really be something if you were the one who got to carry the Ark of the Covenant? Oh, I want to be one of the sons of Kohath. I get to carry the ark. But what if you got one of the boards? I mean, think about it. I mean, we never think about this stuff. What if you got one of those boards? Walking through the wilderness with a board on my shoulder. Man, aren't I great, you know? Why does he always... And this is what happens later on when you've got Korah and his company saying, who do you think you are where you're so spiritual? Why do you always get to be in leadership? Then jealousy arises and so forth and so on. But I digress. But then you get to Numbers chapter 1 and we read those verses and the Levites are not numbered. They don't pay any of this. Why? Because they're the ones doing the work. And so let's go to Numbers again as we close here in a minute. Numbers chapter 1 again. And notice Numbers chapter 1 verses 50 to 54. And it explains why the Levites are not numbered or taxed. But thou shalt appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of testimony and over all the vessels thereof and over all things that belong to it. They shall bear the tabernacle, they shall carry it, and all the vessels thereof, and they shall minister unto it and shall encamp around about the tabernacle. And when the tabernacle setteth forward, The Levites shall take it down, and when the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall set it up. So who's taking it down and setting it up? Are they volunteers? No, they're appointed to do it. Do they get paid anything? Hang on before you answer that. They shall take it up, take it down, and they shall pitch it. The Levites shall set it up, and the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death. And the children of Israel shall pitch their tents, every man by his own camp, and every man by his own standard, throughout their host. But the Levites shall pitch round about the tabernacle of testimony, that there be no wrath upon the congregation of the children of Israel. And the Levites shall keep thee in charge of the tabernacle of testimony. And the children of Israel did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses, so did they. They are the recipients then of some of this money, of this $5 million, whatever we said, or about $5 million. What did they do? Well, Numbers chapter 3, verses 7 and 8. This is the section about the Levites are supposed to serve in the tabernacle. Numbers 3, 7, and they shall keep his charge and the charge of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of the congregation, note these words, to do the service of the tabernacle. Verse 8, and they shall keep all the instruments of the tabernacle of the congregation and the charge of the children of Israel, note these words, to do the service of the tabernacle. So I put that up on the screen, to do the service of the tabernacle. Now go back to Exodus 30. And you read in verse 16. And thou shalt take the atonement money of the children of Israel and shall appoint it for the, and here you go, now you've got these words, for the service of the tabernacle. And so where is this money going? Well, it is in Exodus. When the first registration has taken place, it's for the building. It's for the construction. But was that the only time the numbering took place, the registration? No, it kept happening. Some believe it took place annually. Some believe it took place as needed. But it kept taking place. Why? It had to be maintained. And these Levites would get some of the benefit from this. By the way, you're going to read later on that the Levites, this isn't all they got. They didn't just get money. They were given the first fruits of some of the things that were grown and the animals and so forth and so on for the work that they did. And one of the conclusions that Matthew Henry comes to that I thought was very interesting, those that have the benefit of God's tabernacle among them must be willing to defray the expenses of it and not grudge the necessary charges of God's public worship. See, this is kind of where the rubber meets the road. You know, we're looking through all these facts and everything. Oh, this is interesting that a shekel equals this. Here's the point. Something was necessary for this to be done. It doesn't just happen by itself. I was talking to Megan this morning about pew rentals. And so this afternoon I went back and looked at that because I had copied something. Did you know that in times past, if you came to church, you had to rent your pew? How many knew that? Yeah, you had to rent your pew. Not in Baptist churches necessarily, but in congregational churches. Catholic churches did this. Anglican churches did this and so forth. And it was kind of, somebody called it pay-per-pew instead of pay-per-view. And so I read this article on the time-honored practice of collecting pew rents. Among the original documents tucked away in the archives of the Congregational Church of Needham is the weekly calendar for June 15, 1890. The calendar is notable not only for its mention of something, Strawberry Festival, but also for the general reminder to parishioners that pew rentals are to be paid on a weekly basis and that folks who missed a Sunday service were expected to make up the balance in their next weekly offering. There is an actual picture from the bulletin they found at that church. Can you read it? I didn't know if you could. Oh, man, that's terrible. Let me read it to you. Pew rentals are to be paid by the weekly offering system. Each Sunday, enclose the amount in the envelope which bears that date. In case of absence, one or more Sundays, enclose the amount for those Sundays with the next offering that is to be made and destroy the envelopes that have not been used. The treasurer, de-dresser, will supply envelopes, keep an account of all payments, and give receipts quarterly. So that was in 1890. But this started years before. They had the pew rentals. In fact, I believe it went back into the 1700s. And so it was a way, this article stated, it was a way of raising funds for the maintenance of the church property. So I'm telling you this because when we have our deacons meeting next week, I'm making a proposal. If you sit in the same seat every week, your pew costs more. And Marvin's not even here for me to rib him on it. But you charge by the pew. And here's what I'm going to do. My proposal is that all the back seats are the highest and the front seats are the lowest. I wonder how many people would start sitting up front. You think that might work? And somebody was listing all the pros and cons of this, but they said, these are the pros. If you pay for your seat, you're more likely to show up for church. I like that. Because it said church folk don't like to waste money. It also said, no need to save seats. You've got your seat. Everyone shares equally until you begin charging for the best seats. And people don't like to sleep through something they paid for. So I thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. And so, by the way, this stopped. And there's the next bulletin picture. That's an actual picture of the bulletin. That was in 1904, June 5th, 1904, the weekly church calendar informing the visitors the church no longer collected pew rents. But I think we ought to get back to this time-honored practice. So all in favor? All in favor? Yeah. No, I didn't think so. And I'm not either. But it's just interesting that in years past, people began to recognize, you know what, if this is going to be done right, here's what we're probably going to have to do when everything else falls apart. So folks, don't let us go there. Be a part of what's taking place, even with the maintenance of this building. We tend to think of the maintenance of the building, well, that's not spiritual. It is. It is. It's spiritual. I close with this quote from A.W. Pink. God ransomed Israel to himself in Egypt, but after they had been brought onto redemption ground, after they were redeemed, they were required to acknowledge the responsibility this entailed by bringing their 10 gerahs of silver. So often we dwell upon what Christ's ransom has freed us from. So little are we occupied with what his ransom has freed us for. Now, there's a lot of application in that one statement right there. We sing about redeemed, how I love to proclaim it, and we should. But do you understand that a lot of the songs we sing also have to do not just what we've been redeemed from, but redeemed for? To praise him, to serve him, to encourage one another. We've been redeemed for something, not just from something. And so this one question I ask as we close, when you live your redeemed life as if it's your own, why do you then wonder that you suffer from the plague of God's chastening hand for doing so? Do you understand my last question there? You claim to be redeemed. And God had redeemed these. But he said, number them that there be no plague among them. And then we wonder sometimes, and I'm not saying that when something bad happens, it's because, okay, you're not doing. But I'm saying that sometimes I believe it is. It's God's chastening hand. Because it's not just what we've been redeemed from, folks. It's what we've been redeemed for. Lots of application can be made from that. Lord, we thank you that thou hast redeemed us, that we are saved from the slave market of sin, that the atonement has been made by Jesus Christ, whose blood, his precious blood, it is not of silver or gold. But Lord, once that redemption takes place, you even own our silver and gold. And so now what we are redeemed for takes place. Lord, to be a people redeemed from iniquity, as it says in Titus chapter 2, redeemed from iniquity. Lord, that we might be a peculiar people, zealous of good works. So Lord, I pray that you would use what has been presented tonight from this Old Testament passage and what took place in the wilderness and what you desire to take place in our lives today. Lord, for your glory, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.